Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Hennessy Gas & Energy conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference call over to your host for today, Rob Corsi. Rob, please go ahead.
Thank you, John. Hello and good afternoon, everyone. I am Rob Corsi, the sales director for the Hennessy Funds, and I would like to welcome everyone who's joined us for today's call, which is a very hot topic of late. It's the role of natural gas and oil in the energy transition. We will certainly also be hitting on the geopolitical tensions between Russia and Ukraine. However, for those of you who may not be familiar, the Hennessy Funds are comprised of 16 different mutual funds that are primarily equity-oriented. They span small, mid, and large cap core investing, as well as sector-specific mutual funds. Now, today with us, we have two guest speakers with us. First, Ryan Kelly. Ryan, he's the CIO of the Hennessy Funds and the portfolio manager of the Hennessy Gas Utility Fund. This is a fund that follows an index-based methodology and focuses on the distribution side of natural gas. It is comprised of publicly traded members of the American Gas Association. And thank you for joining with us, Ryan.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Great. Our second guest is Ben Cook. Ben is our portfolio manager of the Hennessy Energy Transition Fund and also our Hennessy Midstream Fund. Now, both of these strategies, they're actively managed, concentrated portfolios. The first fund, the Energy Transition Fund, it includes companies from the entire energy value chain, from E&P companies to energy end users, while the Midstream Fund, it focuses specifically on energy companies that transport, store, and process both oil and natural gas. So thank you for being with us today, Ben.
You bet, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, today's call, it will last about 30 minutes, and it's going to be in a Q&A format. We do want to thank everyone who submitted their questions to us in advance. We did try to include as many of those on our call today, but I want to get right into these questions and give our audience a bit of a global energy update. And I'll start with you, Ben. Renewables as a source of primary energy supply have just grown dramatically in recent years. Maybe you can discuss how both renewable and traditional energy companies really fit together in this evolving energy landscape.
Yeah, you bet. You know, renewables have and are expected to be the fastest growing category of fuels in the primary fuel mix, you know, exceeding the growth in natural gas, crude oil, coal, and nuclear power, at least for the next 10 years. But it's critical to acknowledge the fact that renewable energy growth is inherently dependent upon policy implementation, relative cost advantage, and probably most importantly, reliability. You know, these impediments, if you will, are acting like a governor on the pace of transition. And as long as they're a part of the macro environment, dependence on hydrocarbons will be prolonged. It's our view that renewable energy growth will require expansion in backing up power resources, renewable power resources, even as battery technology and cost continues to improve. And this trend should drive an increased use of cleaner burning hydrocarbons, particularly in the developing world where a significant part of the population will require power as living standards gradually improve. In short, we see natural gas growing as a companion to renewables, as its abundance, carbon intensity, and varied use applications offer a solution to growing global energy needs.
Oh, great. Very compelling, very interesting story there, Ben. And you know what? Let's hit another major news topic. Maybe you can talk to our audience a bit about the geopolitical tension that we're seeing in Eastern Europe, you know, and especially just given Europe's energy reliance on Russia.
Yeah, you bet. You know, as it's been widely covered, Russian troops have amassed along the border of Ukraine, suggesting a high likelihood of an incursion and conflict. You know, as to why, it seems Putin's motivations are driven by a desire to oppose democracy. And of course, he wants to retain influence on former Soviet states and enhance his own domestic popularity. You know, the reality is Ukraine represents a key strategic buffer zone to the West, and control over the country would strengthen Russia's grip on Western Europe and provide leverage against NATO advancement. As for energy supplies, in 2020, about 70% of Russian natural gas exports went to Western Europe by pipeline, and that made up about 45% of the region's import demand. So reliance on Russian natural gas is unquestionable. Right now, there are three major arteries to move Russian gas to Europe currently in operation, and any disruption in exports into Europe on any of these pipelines could place Europe's natural gas balance in a pretty precarious position, particularly so given that 2022 has started with record low European gas inventories. Now, from a volumetric perspective, maximum LNG import capacity into Northwest Europe is a sufficient buffer to compensate for Russian gas flows through Ukraine. But LNG is not an immediate substitute given sailing time and the competition that comes from Asian spot buyers and winter weather there. You know, the main concern for gas is that Russia could unilaterally decide to stop flowing gas to the EU in response to political pressures and or, you know, call it oil sanctions, which seem more likely U.S. or United Nations response. And then just kind of rounding out on oil, Russia exports about 2.5 million barrels a day globally, and about 50% of oil and condensate exports are directed to Europe. So clearly any impact to Russian supplies could create massive problems as European refiners and other consumers scramble for alternatives. And obviously we've seen oil move meaningfully higher as the potential for disruption has increased.
Thank you, Ben. And Ryan, I want to shift over to you. Maybe you can share a little bit with the audience, you know, specifically how these global tensions have impacted the U.S.'s role as a global supplier of natural gas.
Well, sure, Rob. What I'd say is that more than ever, importers around the world want U.S. natural gas. And, you know, already the U.S. is exporting at peak capacity. 2021 marked the first year that we exported more LNG than any other country around the world. And in the final week of January of this year, U.S. LNG exports averaged about 13 BCF per day, which is about 25% greater than last year. So, you know, as a country, we certainly could be exporting more if we had more capacity, but we don't, and we're doing what we can, and certainly there's more coming online here in the near term. So the tensions in Europe have definitely made our exports even more desirable in the short term. Again, mounting pressures about disruptions in Russian natural gas. As a case in point, last June, about 60% of U.S. LNG was going to Asia. In January this year, last month, 70% was going to Europe. So there's a complete flip there on where our LNG is being shipped. And, you know, from the U.S. point of view, whether we're shipping to Europe or Asia or any other part of the world, the economics are very compelling. Prices over here are between $4 and $5 per million BTU. Over in both Asia and Europe, it's $25 for the businesses, including, you know, Cheniere Energy, that's one of the 5% holdings in the Hennessy Gas Utility Fund. And, you know, anybody involved in this business is certainly benefiting right now.
Great. Thank you, Ryan. Now, I want to get back to you, Ben. I want to talk a bit about what we've seen, this recovery in energy pricing. And a two-part question, really. We've seen a meaningful increase in energy prices. You know, how significant are these increases in commodity prices as a tailwind or a contributor to inflation? And also, what is the impact on equities?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the impact of increasing prices is very significant. And while energy as a percent component to overall CPI is roughly 7.5%, and more specifically, natural gas is about 1%, when you consider the fact that the price of oil and natural gas make their way into every other category of goods and services input costs in some way or another, both categories are a very meaningful contributor to inflation. In fact, if you look over the last 5 years or so, oil price is measured by WTI, shows a very strong correlation to CPI. You know, when we consider the impact of inflation on equities, we have to acknowledge the fact that during periods of rising prices, interest rates also tend to move higher, which occurs, of course, because interest rates must adjust higher to compensate investors for reduced purchasing power of the currency. So, you know, as we know, with respect to equities, higher interest rates affect different categories of stocks, say growth or value, to varying degrees. If you look back over history, empirical evidence shows that energy stocks are in fact the best performing category of equities in an inflationary environment. Materials and financials also tend to outperform the broader market as rates rise. And this happened in the 80s and early 2000s. And we see this reoccurring in the current market environment. You know, in our view, hydrocarbon energy producing companies represent probably the best hedge with which to position for an inflationary environment. It's with rising commodity prices that these equities, you know, are capable of generating rising levels of cash. And that offsets the negative inflationary impact on consumer purchasing power.
Certainly a great case you make there, Ben. Ryan, how do these rising energy prices impact natural gas demand?
Well, you know, when it comes to direct usage of natural gas in the home for heating, residential or commercial and industrial usage, there's not as much effect. The effect is much more minimal. And what it comes down to is that, you know, when you need to continue to heat your house and cook your food, you're going to continue to use natural gas or whatever energy source you have. However, where we are seeing a greater effect as prices have moved up over the last year and therefore become less competitive with other alternative input energy sources, the effect we're seeing is negative when it comes to electricity generation, as higher prices have caused some utility-scale power plants to seek cheaper energy sources, namely coal. And this is sort of this is a reversal of what we've been seeing for the last 10 to 15 years, in which natural gas has been absolutely replacing coal as the primary energy source for electricity generation. From 2007 to 2020, natural gas consumption increased 33% at the expense of coal, which decreased 60%. And in 2020, 41% of all electricity produced in the United States was from natural gas, which was more than double any other single energy source or even all renewables combined together. Ultimately, the prime directive of an energy producer or of a utility is to deliver energy to the end user safely and reliably and at an affordable price. And so when we have natural gas prices moving up, you're going to see naturally some coal come back online as, again, they're searching for a cheaper energy source.
Fantastic, Ryan. And let's stick with you on the topic of natural gas. But if we could, let's talk a little bit about the Hennessy Gas Utility Fund. And if you could, let's start with just a quick discussion of the composition of the fund and how many companies have exposure to alternative energy sources.
Sure. The fund is primarily focused on the distribution side of natural gas. These are utilities, major pipeline companies, LNG exportation, and about two-thirds of all the companies in the fund have exposure to renewables. At this point, many more companies that either have some renewables or none are continuing to announce plans to significantly continue to invest in renewables as we continue to go forward here. So, in 2020, 20% of electricity generated was from renewables. That's up from 5% two decades ago. So we will see that continue to rise going forward, as Ben mentioned. It'll be the fastest growing out of all the different categories. Two points that we always like to make about the Gas Utility Fund, however, is that, number one, we don't invest in E&P companies, the exploration and production companies. So the price of the commodity is not actually a major driver of the fund. That's the first thing we want to make sure everybody knows, because that is a pass-through to customers. Secondly, what drives the fund and earnings over time is demand and usage of natural gas and energy in general. And what we like to say is that essentially the more the meter spins, the greater the earnings for these companies. Finally, just to break down what the fund looks like, and this has changed dramatically over the years, but this is where we are right now. We have about 20% of the fund are major pipeline companies, LNG exportation. 15% of the fund are pure play natural gas utilities, and the rest, 55% of the fund, is multi and electric utilities, all of which have natural gas operations, but certainly are much more diversified than pure play natural gas.
Great. Thank you, Ryan. I mean, renewables have just quickly gained a foothold in the space. Next, let's get to earnings, earnings growth expectations going forward for natural gas companies. And maybe if you could give us a little relativity there, just how that, you know, compares to previous years.
Sure. Well, just 5 minutes ago, I got an email coming through my desk from Eversource, and this will be illustrative of what I'm going to say going forward. Through 2026, they expect 5 to 7% increase in earnings per share growth. So earnings per share growth is strong. It's robust. And this is due to the fact that about over a decade ago, three main factors became have led to accelerated earnings growth for these companies. First, the growing importance of natural gas and its usage in and around the country. Second, an increasingly accommodative regulatory environment, which has allowed these companies to earn greater returns. And third, a huge undertaking in pipeline replacement and modernization, which has absolutely driven capital expenditures and subsequently earnings growth for these companies. So in broad terms, the longer-term range of utility growth in earnings going back a few decades was more in the 3 to 5% range. Now it's about 6 to 8%, so almost double the long-term growth rates. One thing I'd add here about how we can sort of look at natural gas utilities and extrapolate what we might be seeing here on the electric side. Increases in natural gas pipeline replacement drove capital spending. It helped to significantly increase long-term EPS growth rates for utilities, for gas utilities. And this exact same thing is starting to happen on the electric side as well. We are entering this phase of, you know, what a lot of people call the electrification of everything. I think it's probably better to call it the electrification of many more things. But it's a time period that we're going to enter in here in which we're going to need a lot more electricity. We're going to need a lot more capacity throughout the grid. And these companies are going to have to invest heavily in order to get there. Last year, I believe it was $755 billion around the globe was invested in renewable energy and the electric grid. And in order to get to the size that we need, we may have to double that through 2030 and then quadruple that again through 2050, according to some studies that we've seen. So that's a lofty goal. I'm not sure we're going to get quite there. But even if we get part the way there, this could be a real boon to earnings growth and the growth in general for the electric side of utilities.
Wow, some big numbers. Ryan, another hot topic would be just the rising rate environment. Can you talk to the audience about how utilities have historically been affected by a rising rate environment?
Sure. Well, we've that utilities manage much better through rising rates than many investors expect. And one of the reasons is that nowadays and for the past, decade or more, built into many of their rate cases are these recovery mechanisms, these cost recovery mechanisms that allow the companies to achieve similar rates of return even when their cost of financing is going up as rates are rising. So, simply put, many utilities onto customers. And we've looked at the annual returns of the Hennessy Gas Utility Fund going back for 32 years since inception. We compared the returns versus many different factors, but one of them being changes in interest rates, and we found that there was no statistically significant correlation between the performance of the fund and the direction of rates.
Okay. Another thing here, Ryan, is investors often talk to us and ask about dividend yields. What is the current dividend yield for the Hennessy Gas Utility Fund? And if you could, also, what are your expectations for dividends moving forward?
Sure. Well, the current 30-day SEC yield for the fund on January 31st was 2.29%. This is within the long-term range of between 2 and 3% that we've seen since inception. You know, again, one of the compelling reasons to invest in utilities is that they do generate consistent dividend growth over time, reasonable payouts, relative predictability. All that continues to hold true, and we would expect that will continue to hold true for into the future. 45 out of the 48 companies that are in the fund pay a dividend, and the average dividend yield of those companies is 3.6% as of today. And the average three-year growth rate is 4.2% per year. So it's a good, strong dividend, and they're growing, you know, steadily over time. And, you know, I'd add that for the life of the fund, since inception, about one-third of its total return came from dividends, and the other two-thirds came from stock price appreciation.
Fantastic. That's a lot of good information for us, Ryan. Thanks. Ben, I'd like to shift the discussion over to you and talk a little bit about the Hennessy Energy and Hennessy Midstream funds. You know, Ben, over the last several years, a lot of energy companies have become fiscally conservative. Can you give us a little update on whether they'll be begin to increase CapEx, really just due to higher demand and higher prices?
Yeah, sure. It's a good question. It's on the minds of many investors. I would say from a historical standpoint, the hydrocarbon energy sector is more fiscally disciplined than at any time in the last several decades. And you know, there's a variety of reasons for that, but I would say, you know, primarily management teams now recognize the risk in ramping spending in a pro-cyclical manner. And equally important, they recognize the key to stock performance has been a move toward shareholder-friendly capital allocation decisions. And more broadly speaking, energy company corporate governance has improved. And as I mentioned, this includes capital allocation measures that are aligned with investors' interests. You know, that means return of capital has become the highest priority for many of these companies. And as we've seen, rising cash levels have allowed debt repayment to be accelerated and shareholder payouts in the form of buybacks and increased dividends and distributions have taken priority over reinvestment. You know, importantly, over the next 12 months, we envision a market demand for oil that will outstrip global production capacity. And that will provide an impetus for growth reinvestment. But, you know, I would tell you we don't necessarily see that impairing the improved alignment with investors. You know, we expect that as these price signals emerge, we do believe hydrocarbon producers will begin deploying cash for volume growth purposes, but only after cash return to shareholder targets have been achieved. So in this way, we see energy companies and continued adherence to free cash yield levels that allow for continued shareholder return. And we expect that companies will only spend those surplus free cash levels, thereby preserving balance sheet and shareholder return integrity.
Great. That all sounds very promising. And Ben, you know what, after a year in which, I mean, we saw some incredible movement. I mean, the energy sector was up over, you know, 50%. Maybe you can, you know, share a little bit about valuations and just how they compare to, you know, historic levels.
Yeah, you bet. You know, we like to look at valuation on a relative basis to the market and, of course, to historical averages. You know, on both measures, the sector screens well currently. And, you know, it looks cheap towards the relative to the broader market. More specifically, on consensus estimates, U.S. E&Ps currently traded about a 65% discount to the S&P 1500 on an EV to forward EBITDA basis. And this is wider than the 5- and 10-year average discount of 45 and 35% respectively. And with forecasts of 2022 crude oil pricing at $76, the current future strip pricing would present upside to estimates by about 5%. So that would suggest an even greater discount than the 65% based on the current consensus. And I would say the large cap group, when you include integrateds, current equity values imply approximately $62 per barrel crude oil pricing, which is well below the current strip price. So, you know, we're looking cheap, you know, relative to the broader market and on crude oil prices. And we're also looking cheap when viewed in the context to the historical valuation range of the sector. On consensus estimates, oil E&P companies are trading at 4 times and 3.7 times 2022 and 2023 EBITDA estimates, and natural gas-weighted E&P companies are trading at 4 and 3.4 times 22 and 23 EBITDA estimates, which put them at the low end of the historical valuation range of approximately 4 to 6 times forward EBITDA. And with respect to free cash yield, and that considers cash availability beyond capital expenditures and dividends, at current valuation, sector free cash yield is currently in the mid-teens, so very attractive. Midstream companies are also screening cheap on consensus estimates. Sector MLP valuation is currently trading at 8.1 times on an EV to EBITDA basis using 2023 numbers, and that's 14% below the average of 9.5 times, which is what we've seen on a five-year average historical basis. C-Corp midstream companies, that valuation is currently trading at 10 times, which is 7% below the five-year average valuation of 10.7 times, again, using 2023 EBITDA estimates. So we believe the combination of strong sector fundamentals, the prospect for rising interest rates, and this, of course, this attractive valuation offer strong appeal on both an absolute and relative basis when compared to other market sectors.
Absolutely. Those deep discounts, I mean, certainly are compelling. You know, maybe Ben, you can also provide the audience with an update on, you know, midstream companies and their payouts.
Sure. Yeah. You know, we're seeing a rebound in industry activity, and that's creating a corresponding rise in hydrocarbon throughput volumes on pipelines. And that's providing midstream companies with rising cash levels, which, you know, as with other energy companies, it's allowing these midstream companies to accelerate debt reduction and of course, increase share repurchase and increase distribution and dividend payouts. Now, as for the current payout level, sector average yields across the MLP subgroup are currently at 7.9%, and C-Corps are roughly at 6.2%. And what's interesting, though, is that the payout coverage levels remain very healthy, with cash payout coverage of roughly 1.9 times. And this essentially means companies have roughly twice the cash available for payout than what is currently being paid. And so in our view, this provides strong potential for rising payout growth going forward.
Great, very promising there. Okay, last question, and I'd like to pose this to both of you. You know, what opportunity, and let's start with you, Ben. What opportunities do you see within the energy and utility sectors?
Yeah, I know. I think that what most energy investors are missing here, even after this run, is that the energy industry is badly depleted, and industry capacity is atrophied after years of underinvestment. And very simply put, you know, this is an industry that requires reinvestment. Capacity must be replenished, and that will mean that people, equipment, and capital will be needed, and that's only going to be attracted with higher returns, and that's only going to come with higher pricing. And we've seen some price spikes around the world, but, you know, interestingly, price spikes really only manage supply and demand imbalances on a short-term basis. Over the longer term, we're going to need to see more elevated, more durable, sustainable elevated prices in order to require the amount of capital necessary to replenish capacity and our ability to produce those hydrocarbons. And so I think for investors, that's an exciting proposition, one that suggests the investment opportunity is going to be longer duration than what we've seen historically.
Fantastic. And Ryan, what about you? What opportunities are you seeing?
Sure. Well, first of all, I just say that there's certainly quite a lot of press, quite a lot of noise, quite a lot of debate about the role of natural gas going forward here during the energy transition. And hopefully we've made the point that natural gas is an important part of all of this. It complements renewables. It fills in extremely well. It provides energy reliably during peak demand, emergency demand, during seasonal demand. So, you know, we firmly believe that reaching net zero emission goals can be done, but it needs to be done concurrently by the entire energy sector, whether it's the electric or natural gas side. As far as just, you know, how the fund is positioned and what opportunities we see there, I mean, the basic tenets of utility investing remain in place. Low volatility, low beta, defensive, good strong dividends, compelling valuations versus the overall market. You know, we see the reopening of the economy driving increasing energy demands of all kind, which will be very beneficial for the midstream pipeline companies and the LNG exporters in the fund. We think natural gas utilities are in good shape from a profitability and performance point of view. And then again, natural gas will be a central component of energy going forward. And in fact, it hasn't slowed down. In 2019 and 2020, the industry added 900,000 new residential customers, which was the largest increase since 2006. Finally, on the electric and multi-utility side, we expect these companies will be driven by a significantly changing energy landscape, the growth of the grid, the growth of electricity production, the growth of renewables. It took over 8 decades for us to build the grid that we currently have. We may have to double it or at least increase it by 50% over the next 3 decades to meet some of the goals that we've placed for ourselves. So there is a whole lot of opportunity there, even if we don't get quite that far, but there's a lot of opportunity for long-term investors in utilities.
Great. Certainly some very compelling stories from both of you. In fact, Ryan, Ben, you know, thank you both really for sharing your thoughts with us today. And on behalf of the Hennessy Funds, I just want to thank everyone for joining us. We look forward to working with you. We hope that you will consider the Hennessy Gas Utility Fund, the Hennessy Energy Transition Fund, and even the Hennessy Midstream Fund as a part of your clients' portfolios. For more information, you can please visit us at hennessyfunds.com, or you can call our advisor line at 800-890-7118. Again, that phone number is 800-890-7118. Thank you all, and have a great evening.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This does conclude today's conference call. You may disconnect your phone lines at this time, and have a wonderful day. Thank you for your participation.